so as yesterday, I will have to speak in English, but I will try to speak quite slowly. So I hope that you can all understand. Also, like yesterday, I will divide my talk into three parts because it is a long time, 2 hours, for either you or me to keep on concentrating. And in between each time, I hope to give you some time to ask questions, make comments. Yesterday I talked about how to understand each other by looking at different civilizations: China, Japan, Islam, Europe, which I didn't cover really, and the Anglosphere, the West. Today I want to talk about how to understand the world in a general way. This is really a talk, or at a level, for postgraduate students. I know that most of you in the Chinese audience are undergraduates, and therefore don't worry if it seems a little difficult or not entirely relevant to you now. Because what I want to introduce you to are three things which you may not be taught about at all elsewhere in your course, and which, if you go on to do further study or become an academic or an intellectual or a writer, may help you. So this may not be directly useful for you in the next year or two, but I hope you will remember a few things that I told you, which maybe in 10 years, 20 years, you'll suddenly remember and will be valuable for you. Because what I'm going to talk about, I call this little book, and as I mentioned yesterday, don't worry if you don't understand or read, understand or remember too much of this today, because it is going to be published in Chinese within the next year or so. And I called it in the preface The Missing Manual, because this is what you are never taught about and told about really when you are students. I was never told this, and so I have had to learn what I'm going to tell you about later on in my life. The manual itself, the little book, is divided into three parts. The first part is about how we learn to understand or find out about our world. And the way an anthropologist does this is through what we call participant observation fieldwork. You go to a place, you participate in the activities. For example, you come to Sichuan University, you give lectures, you meet people, you participate, but you also observe. You keep a diary, you make notes, you think about what you are seeing around you. That is the participant observation fieldwork method, which is the basis of all anthropology. Secondly, the major part of that process is talking to people. You don't, as you might do with animals, just look at them. You have discussions. And it is those conversations with people in another culture which teach you most about that culture. I have learned almost everything I know about China from talking to Chinese friends, and the same in Nepal or Japan. So there is another chapter in the book about conversation and how you have conversations. And then the The third method is by reading works, either reading written works or reading visual works, paintings, photographs, films. You read not just texts, but the world. Now, you will not be taught, probably, in your course about how to read. Everyone assumes that you've been to school and you have learned how to read. But all you have learned is very basic, how to look at characters and turn them into words. Reading properly for high-level academic work is much more than just reading through a page. You have to know, firstly, how to read, and there are special techniques for that. And secondly, how to record what you read. It's no good just reading and taking random notes. You have to take your notes in a particular way, and then to store them, so that you can retrieve what you need for your particular purposes. And students are never taught this. I did two PhD theses, and no one ever told me how to read or how to store information. I had to discover it for myself. Anyway, the book, when it comes out, will help you with those things. The next part of learning about the world is how to actually work on what you have collected through your participant observation, your conversations, and your reading. Through your imaginative work, thinking about it, and through writing. Again, you will not be taught anything about that. It's assumed you know how to think. But you don't, you're not taught it. And it's assumed that you know how to write at a serious level. But you aren't taught that. So the first part of my talk is going to be just taking selections out of it. I will talk to you about writing, how you can write effectively. I've had to learn this through many experiences of PhDs and master's degrees, and through writing book after book after book. And there are some very simple lessons for you, which those may be very useful for you at some point later in your career. And then finally, you need to think about how to set what you find within a theoretical frame. And again, there is very little instruction in your courses, certainly in British universities, on how to think about the theoretical frameworks within which your work is set, and how those frameworks shape what you see and what you write. So I will take out of the last section one or possibly two of the chapters. One on the comparative method in anthropology, and the second on paradigms or frameworks of thought, if I have time. So, this first part is about writing. Now, most of you, as students here, are very rushed. You're running around from lecture to lecture. You have very little time to write or to absorb what you are finding. Later on, if you go on to do maybe a dissertation, I don't know whether you do them in your undergraduate course, they do in Cambridge. And certainly if you do a master's degree or a PhD, you will write a sustained piece of work, a long piece of work, which will take you some months or years. How should you do that kind of writing, which is not just repeating what you have found in books, but it's something new? There is absolutely no point in just going and writing a long piece, which in the old Chinese Confucian tradition just takes the received, the ancient wisdom and then rewrites it down again. That is not research. Research is discovering and communicating something new. So how can you do that? And here are a few tips which most of my colleagues have never learnt themselves or will pass on to their students. The first thing about writing is that it is the most difficult of all human activities. More difficult than painting, probably more difficult than music, because what you are doing is turning electrical signals in your pulses in your brain through complicated processes into a flow of abstract symbols, what you write down. This requires immense attention, very tiring, very difficult. This is why children spend 10 years learning how to write. They don't have to spend 10 years learning how to paint, or to use a mobile phone, or to drive a motorbike, or whatever. That you could do in a few weeks. But to write takes 10, 15, 20 years, which shows its difficulty. So the first thing which I learnt was that how you actually write, where you write, and in what circumstances can make a huge difference. I was told early on that you should find a place where you are comfortable to write and keep that specially for writing. Find a chair, a desk in the library, a bench in the park here, where you think of that is the place where I write. It is associated with writing, it's special, and it's away from distractions. No mobile phones. Essential, you turn off your mobile phones. Essential, you don't tell your friends you're there. And you, because you need to concentrate with all your attention when you're doing proper writing. And I have spent my life finding wonderful places to write. A garden shed in the north of England, in the Lake District, a tea house in my Cambridgeshire home, which those who come this evening I'll show you a picture of. So basically, find a comfortable, quiet, secluded place to write. Second thing is, how do you write? When I was at university at your age, there were no computers. So there was no possibility of typing into a computer. There were hardly any typewriters. I didn't have a typewriter at the start. And anyway, you couldn't take me to a lecture, and you didn't write your essays mostly on computer, on typewriters. So I learned the habit of writing by hand. Later on, I wrote a little bit on computers and typewriters. But now I've gone back to writing with my hands. And I always recommend to my students, if they feel comfortable with it, to write by hand. The advantage, there are several advantages of writing by hand. It takes longer, but you are not distracted. If you have a screen in front of you, especially if it's got automatic spell checking and so on and so on, especially if it's got a little bleep which tells you when someone's put you on their Facebook or sent you a message or want to upload another version of Windows software or whatever. You know, you're concentrating for a bit and then some distraction on the screen. Let alone the fact that you have to sit very formally and type. And of course, quite a lot of your mental energy which you need for the writing is going into the skill of typing. Whereas if you just use a pen or a pencil and just write, there is no effort. Entirely silent, no harm of electronics. The second advantage is that if a pencil or a pen does not crash and paper survives, if you've been writing for a day or two and something's gone wrong with your computer, you've lost it all. So you've got the hard copy in pen. The third advantage is that you then have to type it into computer. And at that stage, you can change it a great deal and improve it a lot. So you basically write it several times. Now, if you put it straight into a computer, it looks very nice. It's all beautifully typed out. It's very difficult to do much with it except just do tiny small edits. But a written thing, you can tear it up, put arrows in, change it round, and then type it in an entirely new form. And as you're typing, I find I add quite a lot to the first thoughts. So, the next thing really is that because writing is so hard, difficult, stressful, strenuous, all the time you're thinking, I don't want to do this, I want to do something else. Now, you probably, the thought won't come like that. It'll come in the form of, oh yes, I can't go on with this until I go to the library and find a book with an article about this. I have to read that first. Or, well, I must go to this lecture and find out more about that. Or, I must go and see so-and-so who will tell me something about it. So you start writing and then you go off. Many of my students, you know, I ask them what they've done and they say, well, I've been to the library 5 times and I've written 2 pages. I said, well, why don't you just stay and write 20 pages? Now, what you do is you say, I'm writing, I'm not going to the library, I'm not going off shopping, I'm not going to answer my mobile phone. I'm going to write. If I don't know something, I don't have to get up and rush off. I write a note as I'm writing. I say, find out more about this, or check this date, or this person, or just put some queries in, and then go on to the next bit of writing. The distractions from writing are many, and I like that. And another useful tip, which I learned many years ago, I was brought up as quite a strict Christian. And as part of the training to be a strict Christian, I was told that I should say my prayers to God. And I was warned that God, of course, is hated by the devil. So the devil would see me saying my prayers, and the devil would suddenly put a thought into my mind, oh, don't forget to buy some coffee, or, oh, don't forget to ring your mother, or, and I would forget about my prayers to God and was distracted. So I was told to keep a sheet of paper beside me, and if the devil told me to go and buy some coffee, as I was writing, I just put coffee, mother, whatever. If you do that, you'll be saved from quite a lot of distractions when you're writing. It's just a simple thing, just to keep a pad of other things which you have to do at another time, but are not necessary then. If you come across something difficult when you're writing, don't struggle with it. Just write yourself a note in the bracket saying, this is really difficult, I don't know quite how to do this bit, and just leave it on one side. I was helped to think about this by a famous English writer who was also a famous children's story writer, C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And he said, writing or reading is like eating a meal which has a fish with lots of bones. So what you do with such a fish, when you're hungry, you take the good, easy flesh off and eat that, and you put the bony bits on the side of the plate. Come back to them at the end when you've got time, when you're not such a hurry, and do the bony bits. So the same with thinking. Do the bony bits later on. The next practical bit of advice is about avoiding what is called writer's block, or being blocked, or a blocked path. If you think of writing as like going along a path, what almost always happens with any good writing is that you're going along this path quite well for a few days or months. Suddenly, you hit a block, and you can't go any further. However hard you think, you cannot get the solution. Now there is one or two simple techniques for getting around this. The main one really is to work on several different pieces of creative writing at the same time. Our minds are very good at multitasking. We could talk, eat a sweet, drive, look out at the road and the landscape, think about things all at the same time. So it's not difficult for our minds to write three or four different things. Obviously not on the same sheet of paper, but at the same time. And the really most productive person I knew, creative anthropologist Jack Woody, was always writing three or four different books at the same time. And I do that. I'm writing 10 books at the moment. Now, the thing about this is, writing is like cooking. It's like you have a stove. If you're making curry, which is what I do with my wife at the weekends, I don't cook up the rice one book. Cook up the vegetables, one book. Cook up the meat, one book. Cook up the potatoes, one book. I have four plates on the top of my oven and another thing. So I'm cooking the rice here, cooking the vegetables there, cooking the meat there. And they're all at different stages. One is coming towards the end, one is just starting. And if you work on several different chapters of your thesis, or articles, or books, simultaneously. This means that this has many advantages. One is that if you get stuck, if you're going along this path, you get stuck, the best thing is just to leave it, to forget about it for a while, and then to go on another path where you've been going along another thought process, which is open. And then you may get stuck further down. Then you go to a third. By the time you've done that and you come back to the first one, you'll find that the block has gone. Your mind has probably solved it. Or you've found a way around it, so onto the other side. If you try and force your mind to solve difficult problems, you won't be able to do it. If you just relax, the problem will probably solve itself. Another advantage of this multi-tasking, multi-writing thing is that each of the different stages of writing requires different mental effort. The first draft, the first writing of the first pages is the most difficult. It requires absolute attention. The first draft, right through, is the most difficult bit. Then revising it, typing it into the computer, or going through and editing it, putting in the footnotes, and so on, requires slightly less concentration. So if you have several things at the same time, you can, in the morning, when you are really fresh, or whenever you really like writing, you do the really difficult bit, and you put that on one side, that chapter on one side, and work on another chapter or book on the editing and checking footnotes and final revisions and so on. And so you rest your mind and you do different things, which is much less tiring than just sitting, slogging away at the book. You should never work on writing for more than 3 hours. People don't tell you that, but writing is so difficult that, for example, one of our great writers, Anthony Trollope, who wrote dozens and dozens of books, very good books. He said that you should never write at full intensity for more than 3 hours a day. Remember that if you are successfully writing for 3 hours a day, even by hand, you can write 2,000 words easily. Now if you write 2,000 good words a day for 5 days in a week, you have a rested weekend, you've written a chapter. And that means that you can write your book or your thesis in 2 months. 8 chapters, 10 chapters. No student ever writes a book in 2 months. But if you could just write a bit and keep at it every day, it'll go along quite quickly. remember that if you limit yourself, you have to limit yourself to writing. I find writing so enjoyable now that I want to go on. You know, I've been writing for 2 or 3 hours and I think, oh, I will. But I know I will get tired and the writing will be less good. So I set myself by saying, I must not do more than 3 hours writing. And then I stop. And then I do the revision and reading and meeting people and all the other things you can do. Another very important thing that took me a long time to learn was how to enjoy writing. And the reason for this, I think, is that when I started doing my first, even when I was doing essays at Kew, certainly when I started to do my first long pieces of writing for doctoral theses and so on, I was told that basically what I had to do was to plan everything out. The whole chapter, each paragraph within the chapter, each sentence within the chapter. I had to work out rationally and formally what would be in this paragraph, what evidence I would have for that paragraph, where the footnotes would be, and so on and so on. Everything mapped out. What I've learned with experience is that that is the wrong way to write if you are going to do really creative writing. Maybe useful for an undergraduate short essay which you can do in a day or two. You have a plan, you write to that plan. But later on, you must not spend too much time working out in too much detail what you're going to write. And I learned gradually to have the self-confidence to be able to just have a very simple idea in my mind. This is going to be a chapter about this. I'll probably cover this and this. I might spend 5 or 10 minutes with a sheet of paper putting down some headings and then putting that on one side and then writing, seeing how it came. There's very good advice by a famous writer who worked on Japan, Hefkaru Hearn. And he said that the way he wrote, and he wrote many wonderful books about Japan, was that he would just sit down in a comfortable chair in the morning and he would have no idea what he was going to write. Just have a sheet of paper and he would just sit and think for a few minutes and then start to write. And after an hour or so, he'd have a little rest. It's very important to have a rest after every hour of writing. And then he would write a bit more, and after an hour, a couple of hours or so, he'd written enough. Put it on one side, go and live his life and get on with other things. Next day he'd come back, read through what he'd written, add some further thoughts, copy out some bits, and then write another hour or two. In that way, with several drafts, he could write a chapter in a week easily, with absolutely no stress. It was as if he was writing a friend, an email to a friend. Just a letter. What he didn't say, and perhaps is worth mentioning, is that all writing is directed towards someone. So you'll find it much easier to write if you imagine who you are writing to. As a student, you are writing for the person who you think is going to read this, which is your teacher. Later, it's for your supervisor, often it's for someone you admire, and I now write for young friends of mine, young children or teenagers or people of your age. A lot of my books recently have been for people of your age. So I imagine a friend of mine who is your age, and all my books at the moment are addressed to Lily or Tarash or Schwab or whatever. And I put that person in front of me and I write the book for them, trying to explain what I want to say to a particular person. And that gives it an immediacy. Another thing which you're never told as a student is that the books you read, the great books you read in anthropology or any other subject history, are not written in the way you read them. You may think, I don't know what your favourite books in any discipline are, but you may think that, should we take a famous old anthropologist, Malinowski, sat down to write Argonauts of the Western Pacific. He wrote the preface, he wrote the first chapter, the second chapter, and the third chapter. He didn't do that, nor did Levi Strauss, nor did any famous anthropologist or historian. Because that is not the best way to write. The best way to write is to start with what you are really excited and interested in. The best way to start writing a longer piece is from the middle, not from the beginning. You write the first chapter right at the end of a PhD. You never write your first chapter then, and obviously you don't write your conclusions. You start with the thing that really excited you and puzzled you and surprised you, the heart of the thesis, which will set you on fire in your writing. That will then suggest to you, now I've got here, this is obviously the next thing I should do, because that's interesting and relevant. You go on to that, and so on. So you follow what your mind tells you to do. You don't try and do it in a logical order. And it's only near the end of writing that you come back and look at it and rearrange it in what seems to be a logical order. And it's very important to know that while you're writing, you don't know what you're going to write or what the conclusion is going to be. Your writing, in a way, is to discover what you don't know and also to find out what the question is. The questions, if they are good, are so deep that you really don't know them when you're writing. It's only when you have given a sort of answer that you go back, write the introduction to tell the reader what the question was to which this is an answer. The idea that you set out with this question and you're going to answer it is a model from physics and the natural sciences. It's not the model of writing creatively in the arts and humanities. I often think of writing as similar to lighting a fire. If you were lighting a fire with wood and paper, what you do is that you get a few very small pieces of wood and bundle up some paper and make a very simple start with a few sheets of paper which you light and put some twigs on, some small pieces of wood. Once that has caught fire, then you put slightly bigger pieces of wood on. Once that caught fire, bigger pieces. When you're writing, your mind catches fire from that first ignition, and then gradually you add more information and more length, and you get a really wonderful, great bonfire. But you start simply right in the middle of the bonfire and let it go up. Another thing that you're not told is that you should not worry about what comes out when you write. In my early writing, I was much too controlling. If I thought I was going on too long about this subject, I kept remembering, well, the length of this, the word length is so many thousand words. If I use too many words here, I won't have room there. I kept trying to stop myself if it began to go on. Or if I went off onto what seemed to be not the central subject I was meant to be dealing with, I stopped myself. One of our greatest English writers, Rudyard Kipling, who did the Jungle Book and so on, said, never write short. In other words, just let it be as long as you want and shorten it later. It's just like filmmaking. If you were making a television documentary, you wouldn't start filming and think, oh gosh, I won't use more than 20 seconds out of this sequence. Therefore, I should stop after 20 seconds. You take an hour of film, and then later you decide which of that film is useful. Remember, above all, that writing is it's a second kind of fieldwork. I mentioned participant observation fieldwork. Most anthropologists are taught that what they do is they go and gather all their data and then they come and write it up. That's what we tell our students. They are doing writing up, as if the writing up was just a purely mechanical matter. Like in archaeology, you dig up the objects and then you write a research report on what you find. Anthropology is two field works. There's the field work when you are gathering the data and participating and observing. And then a more difficult but more important field work, which is the year or two when you come back and you try to understand what you've seen, rearrange it, put it into new patterns, reimagine it. It has to be completely rethought and imagined. And our students have not taught anything about that. But there is a chapter in this book about reimagining the field. Another very useful, very small tip, and obvious once you see it, is that because writing is so difficult and stressful, I learned early from a historian that when you're writing, say, something which will take you some days or weeks, you should never finish off a section of your writing if there is going to be a pause. By that I mean, at the end of the day, say after 2 or 3 hours writing, you should not finish that section. You should nearly finish it and then write a little note saying, tomorrow I'll just go on and finish this off. Even more important if you've got a weekend, 2 or 3 days. Even more important if you're going away for a month or two. Because if you finish off something, and then you are faced, after a 2-week break, with a blank sheet of paper or blank screen that says chapter 3, you sit there, you don't know what to do, where to start. If you've already more or less done it, and you just finish it off, by the time you finish it off, your mind is warm, ready to go on, and you just easily go on. It's a very useful tip. Another tip is that writing is not just done at your desk or with a computer or with a sheet of paper. You must have already discovered that all your best ideas don't come when you are sitting at your computer or with a sheet of paper and writing. Your best ideas come usually when you're not really thinking directly about the subject. I've asked and interviewed many famous anthropologists, historians, philosophers, and they all said, well, I asked them when they had their Nobel Prize winning moment and so on. All of them say, well, I was going for a walk and talking to a friend. Or a famous example, the great French mathematician Poincaré, who was more or less simultaneously discovered the theory of relativity with Einstein. Poincaré, one of his great breakthroughs, he'd been thinking hard about a mathematical problem. He went off for a holiday at a conference to the south of France, and hadn't been thinking about it, and as he put his foot into the bus to come back to Paris, in the second putting his foot on it, he had the solution to this mathematical problem, immensely difficult. Perhaps an even more dramatic example is Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin describes how, you know, he'd been puzzling and walking, working, trying to work out the theory of evolution of species. And then finally, the breakthrough occurred. He was driving in a coach somewhere in London, and the coach hit a stone. Charles Darwin was thrown in the air. He said that between being thrown in the air and landing back on his seat, he had the theory of evolution. Simultaneously with Darwin, as you know, two people simultaneously discovered the theory of evolution, Alfred Russel Wallace. Alfred Russel Wallace is an example of another form of famous solution of problems, which you maybe have encountered, which is that the most difficult problems sort when you're slightly not able to concentrate entirely. That's, for example, if you've been drinking. Lots of poets drink a lot and then they write wonderful poetry because they're not too over-rational. Alfred Russel Wallace had read Malthus's great book on population, which stimulated the theory of evolution for Darwin. And he'd read it and he got a fever and he was in some jungle in Malaya or Borneo, and he was tossing and turning on through the night with this fever, and suddenly the combination of what he'd read and his thoughts solved the problem of the evolution of species. I've found recently, and many of you will, that many of my best thoughts occur either when I'm walking. Walking is a wonderful way of solving problems. If you have a problem which you can't solve in your mind, go for a walk. This is what Max Weber did. He said, I think about the problems at my desk, but I always solve them away from my desk. Well, Charles Darwin had a thinking path where he used to walk round and round. We have an English or Latin statement, solvitur ambulando, it is solved by walking. Einstein said, the legs are the wheels of creativity. And the other occasion is after sleep. Very often, when you're halfway between sleeping and waking, all sorts of very interesting thoughts come. You make those connections which you can't do when you're fully awake. So some of my friends keep a pad of paper beside their bed, and I have one in the kitchen, and sometimes I have to rush there before I have my shower and write down a few thoughts that I've had just in those minute or two of waking. So the last thing I want to say and stress is that writing, academic writing, is a form of discovery, creativity, and research. The actual writing is the research. You often don't know what you know. Your mind is much more powerful than you imagine. And often I start writing. My best books have always been ones where I didn't know what I was going to write. And I wrote, for example, my Letters to Lily or The Origins of English Individualism, were both books which I described to myself as having written themselves. They seemed to write themselves. So after a day of this kind of creative writing, often you really don't know what you have written. My wife often asks me,